Clarification. Oh, my darling Clementine. Yes, that old archetypal story. Oh, my darling. Oh, my darling. Oh, my darling Clementine. Excellent. It's funny how these things live in your mind. You just you mentioned the word, and then I'm gone. I'm in Australia. I've never been to Australia, but that's where I went. Okay.
Yeah, does that diagram relate to that one?
Yeah, it does. It's I haven't drawn any lines on it, but it's the same 10 elements.
I don't know when. Is it deep image?
Okay, I'll come back to that in a moment. Let's not get fixated now. I'm not going to start there. I'm going to come to that in a moment. But I want to step back, first of all, into this whole territory of the living image, icon, idol, all these territories we've been looking at. And the whole idea of the image, the whole idea of creativity, and in a way, human nature, is really linked with this expression of this intention that expresses itself through a living image. Now, as human beings, we inherently create. When we're a baby, and even before we're a baby, when we're in the womb, we are experiencing a changing sense of ourself and a changing sense of our world. So certainly when we're actually in the womb, that we're in this environment that is not terribly externally clear to us. We don't have the senses to do that. But what we're in touch with, of course, is an enormous internal changes. And if we consider that we begin as a single cell, and if you think of the creative process that the cell goes through from being the fertilized ovum to becoming a fetus, it has to make this extraordinary journey down the fallopian tubes. It has to find its way into the womb, but it has to find a way to implant into the womb lining. So it has to move from a place of independence to dependence. It then has to draw on nourishment, which it then transforms its structure. Having been one thing, one cell, it becomes two cells, it becomes four, it becomes eight, it becomes an embryonic disc, which then flips completely and becomes a globe. And having become a globe, it then starts to generate a midline, and it becomes differentiated into a top, a middle, and a bottom. Limbs bud on it, sense organs, so this is extraordinary kind of creative kind of process where this is a cognitive and conscious, but the what unfolds in that process is the living image of the human being. And if the kind of that's all guided by DNA and guided by this sort of living template that creates the particular form of the human being, that is not generic form. It's a form that it's an uniquely created form that arises out of the genetic material of the mother and the father, but comes together in a completely new configuration. So the image of the human being is both generic and highly specific. Involved in the genetic experience of the father and the mother and the ancestral lines that they're part of. you know, each child, in a sense, if you like, is a coming together of two or ancestral lines in an unique configuration. So even right at the beginning of life, even in this just biological kind of place, there is a sort of a coming together of an image that is both uniquely personal and connected to both the generality of being a human being and the particular ancestral inheritance that comes from the mother and the father. Now, and that's just one set of influences. The other set of influences, of course, that are around, even at that early stage, is the actual mother, the actual father, the social environment they're embedded in. So the sense of the human image is fed really by lots of different currents. And so, you know, we have, you know, this whole world of the fetus, you know, the fetus that is, you know, the great features really of fetal life is dependence. There is the actual physical connection between the fetus and the mother, the inescapable connection. Now, the next massive thing that happens there is the experience of birth and the experience of tremendous kind of separation and passage and transformation from one world into another world, from the fetal world, the world of the womb, to the world of separate existence. Still profoundly dependent existence, but separate existence. Now, as we talk about the human image, of course we are looking simultaneously really at collective experience, ancestral experience, archetypal experience, and also profoundly personal, particular, immediate experience. What happened to you? What happened to me? Now, in the background, however, we've got these much larger archetypal fields. Now, and our creativity is all the time managing this, creating a kind of a sense of self, a sense of world that we can live with. And that's really what we, you know, the great quality of human beings is almost this extraordinary adaptability. People can live and to a certain extent thrive in the most hostile of environments. People can find, you know, one of the things I remember once about going to Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial many times years ago, is looking at the children's drawings of the camps, which you would expect, of course, to be horrific, and some of them are. And some of them are really normal, and there's nice flowers, and there's sort of and there's pictures of kids playing games, and sort of, and it's a kind of shocking to see, because, you know, the background of the camps, the guards, the SS people, and then but the main focus maybe the kids playing ball or a nice little flower that a kid has found. So the capacity to, if you like, create a certain degree of what we could call paradise even in the most hostile circumstances is hardwired into the human experience. So we create a sense of balance and stability even in the most awful environments. Now, of course, if you're in needing to create that level of stability in that kind of environment, there's all kinds of things you have to do to help yourself feel safe, and all kinds of ways in which you would contain and confine yourself. So the image of yourself and the image of the world that you would create would be something like, you know, I must be nice to the powerful people, I must keep myself away from them, I must keep my life energy very low and not draw attention to myself. You know, so the cost, of course you create stability, but in extreme circumstances the cost of that is you create a very narrowed image of yourself, perhaps, And in this world of the camp, which of course becomes the total world. Now, the thing that is very difficult for Holocaust survivors when they come out of camps is the camp comes with them. Right? Because the camp is the world, and that's kind of what we do. We create, there's this interlocking of the human, of the image of ourselves with the image of the world that creates that stability. Now, when we either change inside ourselves or the world changes. That stability starts to become rock, starts to separate. So you can find that even in small things, like, you know, that, well, not so small, I suppose, but not terrific. It's Brexit, right? So I know for me, I've thought myself as an European, I've loved thinking of myself as an European, and the whole idea of Brexit affects, you know, there's all kinds of things it affects. But one of the things it affects for me is my image of myself. I'm not going to be able to think of myself as an European. Suddenly I'm a Brit, and I'm Welsh. I hate being a Brit. Well, it's being Welsh. I'm fine with being Welsh. I never wanted to be a Brit. Suddenly I'm a Brit. Fuck, I'm a Brit. What's that mean? I don't really like that. Like, so, do you see what I mean? It's not the specifics of me, you know. It's really that interlocking that happens between our image of ourself and the image of the world. Now, we all do that. It's part, you know, it's intrinsically part of human nature. Now, if we go right back in cultural history, if we go back to the sort of, if you like, the Bronze Age and before, the sense of the imaginal, the sense of the imaginal world, is much closer to human beings. There's a sort of the sense of direct access to the archetypal, and the sense of a solid separate self is much smaller. If you ask a Homeric Greek why you did something, he could say in a court of law, a god appeared and made me do this. And in a court of law, that would be regarded as a true explanation of why something happens. Now, if you go to court and you say, why did you steal this? Why did you steal that from the shop, Mr. Rees? A god appeared and made me do it. Now, Mr. Rees is delusional or lying or whatever. But and that's because our access to the imaginal has altered. Now, there's obviously downsides in that. But also, one of the things that you find in the kind of very early Bronze Age societies is a lot of things that gods tell you to do is kill your enemies and kill the enemies of the tribe. Now, there's obviously great problems in being cut off from the imaginal, but one of the things that you see happening in something that the cultural historians call the Axial Age, which is when you get the kind of the rise of Islam, the rise of Christianity, the rise of in certain kinds of Indian religion in India, Buddhism, also as the time when Buddhism appears, you start to get that image of the gods that just compel people, which are in a way archetypes possessing people. You find a new cultural image arising in the collective unconscious, the image of the human being. So in Buddhism, we get image of the Buddha. Now, the Buddhism's interesting around this because the Buddha operates in the Vedic world where there are many, many gods. And if you look at the early scriptures of Buddhism, the Buddha is probably more than any of the great world religious leaders talks about the gods, talks about the archetypes. Now, he regards gods as powerful but limited beings. And part of what you find in the early sutras is the Buddha going off to talk to the gods, to help the gods move beyond their limitations. So the Buddha gives us an image of an image of the human being who is this bridge, really, between the unmanifest and the manifest, and who works with all the images of the world. You find the same things. You don't just find this in the sort of monotheistic religions. You find this certainly you certainly find it in Welsh and Irish culture. When we look at the figures of the bards. Now, one of the things that you see arising in Welsh and Irish tradition is the image of the of bards like Amavigin, Taliesin, what's the Irish woman, Lochtia. There's the great druidess Tlochtia. So you get these human images that arise, that mediate the god images that are in a sense greater than the gods. So, for example, in the Mabinogion traditions that we've been looking at, the main figures are human figures that in some ways incorporate the images of the gods. So, in Welsh tradition, you get the image of Ceridwen. Ceridwen is a woman living with Tegid, the bald, her husband, and who has this son, and has this son, Avagdi, who's incredibly ugly. And she wants to solve her, because she loves her son, she generates the cauldron of inspiration so that people will not hate her son. Now she is using these great archetypal energies at the service of a very human problem. When Taliesin says, "I was with Jesus on the cross. I stirred the cauldron, as the cauldron of Ceridwen. I was here at the beginning of time." He, as a human being, is incorporating and bringing together all the archetypal images within the human form.
Why does Taliesin, the boy who's stirring the cauldron, he gets the drops, not the child?
Because life is random, right? The thing about these stories is that they point at the creation or at an universe that is profoundly creative. And therefore, at time is random, and therefore not fair.
Chaos,
exactly.
It's also that we can't cure the ugly child, does that?
Well, it's interesting, because the story of Mavran Avagdi is that his ugliness in the end is transformed in a funny kind of way, but he could become this extraordinary warrior who because of his ugliness, no enemy can stand against him. So there is a way in which Mavran Avagdi's story becomes transformed, but not by becoming beautiful. The problem of the Avagdi story, I think, is if he became the man with the beautiful voice, so people would look past his ugliness is rejected. In the Welsh story of Mavran Avagdi, the need is that ugliness is somehow embraced and then becomes in an odd kind of way beautiful. Because he becomes this superlative warrior, he's one of the warriors who survives the Arthurian story. Survives the great battles of Arthurian story because he is this consummate warrior. Because his very ugliness is this tremendous power of warriorship that terrifies the enemy. So it's a subtler story than just the transfer. You know, because in a certain sense, also it's a sort of, if he had just she just did it and he's made beautiful and it all works. It's a slightly finished story as well. Because actually the point of that story is in the question you've just asked. What about poor old Mavran? Mm-hmm. Right, the thing is about these stories is they, useful archetypal stories are unfinished, they're incomplete. We ask the question, well, why is that then? And in asking that question, we bring the story present and we make it personal. Right, we start to embody that. You asking me that question and me saying, well, it's like that for Mavran Avagdi. Now his name is interesting. Avagdi means utter darkness. Mavran can mean simultaneously great raven or sea raven. So a bird, a carrion bird, who is also in Welsh Nigrid tradition, the messenger of the goddess. So the luminous, powerful, dark, disturbing energy that feeds off death and takes nourishment out of death. So it takes us into shadow, right? So we're talking about shadow. It takes us into he is Taliesin's shadow, and shadow and Taliesin is Brightbrow. He's the luminous, the beautiful child. Mm-hmm. Without the shadow of Mavran Avagdi, something very important in the dynamic is lost somehow. Yeah.
And if you go back to the cell, the seed, the embryo.
Yeah.
Which is quite a random combination.
Yeah.
Drops are really, to me, just a symbolic way of saying, well, they each got the drops they were allocated when they were conceived.
Yeah.
And that's how it turned out.
That's right. That's right. And the thing that's nice, I think, about the story of the drops is the randomness as well. It's the chaotic nature of the universe, right? Because actually how he gets the drops is they just plop out of the cauldron. It land on his hand. His hand is burning. He puts his hand to his lips and he drinks the drop purely by accident.
Yeah.
So it's a challenging story because it says actually there isn't some just nice orderly thing just managing everything. Actually, there's a sort of the creativity is also random, also chaotic.
Like teachers get enlightened when a teacup smashes on the ground.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, there's also the thing of someone doing something to and for someone else.
Yes, that's right. Okay. Yeah.
But also, there's something about the man, the son that's very arguing, the fact that he can't change it. It's rather like coming into a relationship with it. I mean, something, the process takes him into something completely else, but
yes.
Only people frightened and he's a great warrior. So yeah. that somewhere it's trusting how you are is
yes.
takes you somewhere.
Yes.
And it's so difficult to accept that.
Incredibly hard, isn't it? Incredibly hard for all of us to accept that. But actually, that's the deeper bit of that story. Mm-hmm. Absolutely so, yeah.
That's what I'm starting to appreciate. You know, that Alan Gardner was actually talking about the way that literature, these stories are passed on.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say written because that's another thing altogether, but how they're passed on. It, to include the paradoxes, to include the ambiguity, allows the reader or the listener to their own interpretation. And that's what I've just heard from everybody, because it's allowed everybody to interpret.
Yeah.
Where with modern day sort of films, the stories in films are often they're closed down, they're not filled
with
interpretation.
Yeah. They're not inviting that. It's the icon and the image again, isn't it?
Yeah.
The story allows you through into the truth you want to find within it.
And the very words that are used.
Yeah,
just starting to appreciate.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's right. And I think there's that. I mean, what Alan Garner really well elucidates often, I think, is that the living power of myth, in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, and how myth is inescapable because we create and recreate our own myths. We talk about Neil Gaiman and American Gods, and he looks at the mythical in the landscape of modern day America. But you know, but of course, we all that this quality is something that we all do. We all mythologize because our life story, certainly when you know, and the story of our family and the story of the families we have associated with, you know, is a sort of tribal history in a sense, right? It is something that. That you know, there are these. It's exactly my own family. Part of the rage and mental health issues in my family are connected with the fact that that all the family money got lost because somebody speculated on a bridge in Mid Wales, spent all the family money on a bridge, and you know I don't even know where the bridge is, but it's a story, you know, so that we'd have been rich farmers near Macintyre somewhere, apparently, if whoever this damned ancestor, and he's like this damn near damnable figure who spent all the money, wasted the substance, right? So the Rees family kind of in whatever nightmares it was, and later went on to enact. And as part of that, this kind of fuck, if only that bloody bridge, we'd be rich and we'd be successful and we would kind of and it you know, it's part of the family myth somewhere, and you know, we've all got versions of that, and in a sense these versions of story, these are part of the archetypal waiting, if you like, of our own story, being Welsh, being Irish, being from Yeovil, being from Shepton Mallet, there's a sort of, if you like, archetypal kind of edge to everybody's story. So as we look at transforming our story, creating new possibilities, as well as, of course, the personal work that we need to do, we have to involve the ancestral and the archetypal and find a relationship to that. And you know, the is when we do the meditations we've just been doing, where we take on this sort of this transitional form, you know, which is a it's kind of generic form of loving, wise, powerful, and then start to embody that and start to engage with regal archetypes or religious archetypes, so that then become personal kind of images that start to reorganize our process. And the reason they can do that is because we are continually generating our sense of self and generating our sense of world. That's the process that we're doing all the time. If it was a once and for all deal, well, you're stuck with it. The whole thing about the process of being a self and envisaging the world is it's a continual moment by moment process. So it's a sort of dynamic balance. It's a bit like, you know, when you're wading across a stream, you've got, in order not to fall over, you have to keep finding balance. Right? You have to keep, with each step, you have to keep moving, but you have to keep your sense of balance. So it's much more like that rather than static balance. So it's a bit like, if we were looking at that, the scales are swinging back and forth. We don't want them to stick one end. We want the amplitude of the swing to be so much that actually the whole balance breaks. Right. So it's a dynamic balance that we're wading through, in a sense, negotiating our sense of self, our image of the world. And you know what can happen to us, and you know, as has happened over this last year of Brexit, Donald Trump, horrible things happening in London or in Nice or in Paris, is externally the world breaks and the internal image distorts and changes, and then we find a new sense of self. I mean, one of the things I remember after 9/11. Was realizing I could never look at a plane in the same way again. So my image of a plane had altered. I'd never before that thought of a plane as a weapon. Obviously, dropping bombs and stuff, but an ordinary plane since 9/11 is also a potential weapon. So obviously we're impacted all the time from the external environment. Now that feeds into this internal sense of creativity, which we are all the time, if you like, backed up by our ancestors and the gods that are attached to their ancestral line. Now that actually manifests it can if you're doing ancestral work in actual experiences, but more normally it is expressed in a sense of solidity. The solid sense of who I am and the sense of what my world is like. So you get these ideas of national characteristics that emerge. So it's well known that the Welsh are brooding and resentful, right? I mean, that's of course a great generalization. Plenty of Welsh people who aren't like that. But generally speaking, actually, that kind of scratch the surface, you find it in quite a lot of us. Now that is, of course, connected with historical experience. It's connected with experiences of internalized inferiority, of being, which comes out of, in a way, being very close up to Edward I and being the first English colony. You know, so this, you know, and experiences of humiliation of actually the Welsh chieftains agreeing to take the king's son as Prince of Wales. In a sort of, as an act of humiliation. That lives on. Hugely shaming, right? So that sense of shame, the sense of shame and resentment and rage that arises out of that, lives on in most Welsh people in some degree or other. Now, just using that because it's my own living example. We've all, you know, everybody's line has that sense. But unless you're conscious of it, if you're conscious of it, it just gives you a bit of space around it. Like if I remember that, when that resentment rises up and I kind of, you know, it's, and it is a strong, I remember Ali's mum once saying, describing a district nurse. It's a small thing, but it's an interesting thing, where she said, when she was talking about the woman, she said, she's English, but she's very nice. Right, and it's a sort of, wow, right? Where did that come from? You know, Elsman, really nice woman, not aggressive, I'm sure would have been perfectly nice to the district nurse. But where does that come from, that idea? Now, it comes, of course, from ancestral wounding expressing itself in a really ordinary, simple kind of way. Right, because somewhere, if you followed that enough, there'd be a link into that sense of Welsh humiliation, old wars, old defeats, old humiliation, So sort of resentment of the English, so you could say hatred of the English, you know, in the relating to the English as the superior oppressor, the person of power who humiliates us and puts their foot upon our neck and makes us feel ashamed.
Flooded our valleys,
took our water. There's a whole history, right? There's a whole, and you know, the
and yet still turning away flags for Prince Charles when he
that as well. That's very it's very complicated. You identify with you identify with the oppressors. You create splits. South Wales is much more Anglophile than North Wales. Lots of other things happen, right? So lots of splits happen. But the thing is that's why we can't get away from the archetypal. Right? We can think we can, but we never can, because actually it's impressed in. It's like a seal pressed into wax. It's in us somewhere. And so what we have to do, and what we have been doing all these years, is really turning our attention back, looking into it, really listening to the energies that emerge, and then bringing in other images of healing, images of new possibilities. And in a way, the what we're looking at, specifically looking at in this course, because we're not really looking necessarily at the material so much, we're looking at the process that happens. So what we're looking at, and what we've been looking at in these meditations today, is okay, if I come into my body, get present, create a sense of balance, generate a sense of flow and energy, right? So I'm inviting in a dynamic sense of balance, and then I create a sense of movement and flow. So I'm setting up a field of intention, right, which has this sense of possibility, of change, and has this sense of being able to move forward in a balanced way without losing it. Then what I do is I invite in a different sense of self. I lean into a deeper archetypal image of myself that has more possibilities. So the image of myself as wiser, powerful, loving, that can then engage with the old wounds in myself and the wounds in the world, and be more effective, be wiser, be kinder. So this bridging image, which you find in all spiritual traditions, really, and mostly what happens is that people identify with the founder of a religion. Now, the founder of a religion, in a sense, or a spiritual system, embodies the archetypal ideals of that tradition. So in a sense, the Buddha, you could say, is almost certainly an archetype of wisdom. You know, he's also he retains love as well, actually, and also when you go into the deeper aspects of Buddhism, he's incredibly powerful. The Buddha as among world religious founders, exhibits more psychic power than any of the other founders. He's all the time manifesting through his divine eye. He's creating images. The Buddha is incredible. You know, if you look at the early Buddhist sutras, you see a lot of really interesting stuff that's around imaginal work, the Buddha working imaginally. In Western accounts of that, because Western accounts have really wiped out the imaginal, that's regarded as Asiatic superstition, and it all gets ignored in favour of this rather wise, rational, calm philosopher Buddha, you know, because we make the Buddha into a different kind of image. Mm-hmm. Buddha is a profoundly shamanic and intriguing figure, really, in some ways.
I include Merlin in that, or are we going to totally different mythic realm?
The problem with Merlin is that you could include Merlin, except that he is a character in a story. Well, the Buddha is, and of course the Buddha is also a character in a story, but the question I would have for that is Merlin embodied? And I don't know the answer to that. I would think there was originally a figure, right? What I think happens, and the trouble is we don't have the evidence, but...
So the archetype originally always has to have been embodied?
No, archetypes can be very, very disembodied, but what I'm talking about here, I suppose, is the image of a human being. Now, so Merlin could be such an archetype, right? And probably is such an archetype, because Merlin is a human being. Just like Taliesin is a human being, just like Buddha is a human being. The problem we have with the problem we have around some of the Welsh and Welsh figures, and not just Welsh but Irish figures, is is we don't know enough of the ordinary about them. There are things that we know about the Buddha that is a bit more ordinary, like the fact he died from eating gone-off pork.
You don't know of Merlin's pain, do you?
We don't know much about Merlin's pain. You know a bit about it from the Vita.
From the mythic stories.
Yeah, but the trouble is we only know it from the mythic stories in a certain sense, right? And
aren't these all mythic stories? That we
well, they vary. They vary, right? So the interesting thing about something like some of the stories of Jesus and the Buddha is there are more ordinary kind of details found inside them.
Right.
Right, so that's one of the differences. And there would have been, I imagine, about, you know, if we were telling the story about whoever was the bard that was Merlin, there would have been ordinary things. We're partly talking about cultural destruction in some ways.
Yeah.
Right, so one of the things that we know that Christianity did was to wipe out a lot of the older traditions completely. So a lot of old stories, we were dealing with the fragments of stories. Right, so... But there's an interesting edge here that actually if you start to relate to Merlin, the question is how do you relate to him? Do you relate to Merlin as a human being or do you relate to Merlin as a god? Now, if you if we think of Merlin as a human being, so let's think of Merlin as, for example, sake of argument, as a, I don't know, 6th century bard. Right, so let's say here's a 6th century bard who knows these ancient stories, similar to Taliesin, knows all these ancient stories. And he's at the cusp of a world, he's transmitting a story. Well, how far can we feel the humanity of Merlin? In particular, where do we experience his pain? Where do we experience his loving heart? And so that's, if we were going to work with that image and work with it in the way that I'm talking about it, we'd have to look at Merlin as a human being. And can we do that? Does that work?
Doesn't that bring us to Arthur?
Yeah, can do, go on.
Doesn't Arthur then represent that aspect of Merlin?
Well, the same problem with Arthur in a certain sense, right? In that Arthur is the ideal king, he's the ideal, I think what we're looking at, what we're starting to look at here really is this whole business of what happens when an archetype becomes separated away from the everyday. So what we have to do, the work that we have to do is in this idea of redeeming the archetypes or reconstructing the archetypes, is if we're going to work with that image, well, that image then has to speak to us and we have to almost interrogate that image. To look at, well, where is the humanness in you? Where is the pain in Merlin?
Well, you could argue that the pain in Merlin, he was a fatherless child.
Yeah.
That's an aspect of pain.
Yeah.
When he, after the Battle of Caledon, when he was mad in the forest for a certain amount of time, his mental pain was intense. His relationship, with his sister, with Nina, was a relationship that humans can recognize.
Yeah.
There are aspects of humanity around the construction of Merlin. I agree it's fragmentary because of the...
Yeah. And now what you're starting to do, as you do that, we start then to create the... You see, we then start to embody the archetype, right?
Yeah.
Right, that's when we start to bring it present. We start to bring this. So this is true. This is, and you're right, of course. Actually, Ben, I think it's slightly playing devil's advocate, but not entirely, actually, because what you have to do with any of these images is we have to bring them present here and now. Have to bring the archetypal quality present with the human quality. Yes. We have to embody them in human form.
Tell you the reason I asked you, because I accept that. Jesus is incredibly influential spiritual current that is embedded.
Yeah.
And what we've been talking about is spiritual currents. Now, as a Druid, I don't have that religious context. I have a spiritual there. So I just picked out Merlin as holder of a spiritual current of man and land. I think has been,
Totally.
Very relevant in these islands. Although,
who else would occur to you if you stay with that? So Merlin is one. Who else would step forward into that if you were thinking about? We're just thinking about the human beings who stand for the land. So who else comes to mind?
Well, Well, the ones that you've mentioned, the bards who sing for the land.
Yeah.
And anyone who is a mediator, really.
Yeah.
So all the ancient druids who mediated between, you know, the tribes, the gods, and the land.
Okay.
But they're nameless, you know.
Yeah, great. So if you, just for sake of argument for a moment, Ben, just if you just lean back into the nameless druids, the nameless bards, just see what happens. What happens to you when you just bring them present through you, through your nature?
Pretty well what is happening when I did the earlier meditations. It's like putting on the robes.
Yes, good.
Yeah.
Right, great. So then you start to mediate, right? The archetypal image of being the druid starts to become enfleshed and embodied in you.
Yeah.
And so that archetypal role and its history and its ancestral history starts to become present. Now, in my experience, not just to you, because actually what happened then is that sense of druidness, to invent a better word, starts to come into the room. You know, I feel this, oh wow, that's interesting, the sense of the land, the sense of that deeper thing starts to come in through you. And that's what we do, I think. That's this act of embodiment.
Yeah.
So, on, you're trying to get in a bit early. What?
Well, I suppose I'm just a bit confused about the way that we're using the word archetype.
Okay.
Because I would have thought that Merlin would be the holder of the archetype of magician.
Well,
I was thinking that in those terms, and then I was thinking about Merlin, and I was thinking, well, because Jesus Christ, everybody's heard of Jesus Christ,
yeah.
And Buddha, you know, most people have heard, so they somehow have managed to take up a bit more real estate in people's psyche than Merlin, in a way. So it's like, so I'm curious about this thing of the collective unconscious and the archetypal...
Yeah. Yeah.
Mantle of magician or
that's just
or healer or whatever it is.
Yeah, let's look at this a little bit actually, because the thing about a lot of Jungian approaches to archetypes, well, actually Jung's own approach to archetypes were quite reductive, because what he does is to identify typologies. So there's healer, magician, I can't remember them all now, but the trickster, there's a whole Yeah, father, that's right. So he does an abstraction. So he creates an abstraction out of something that. So when we think about archetypes, we think of that level of abstraction. Now, the archetypal image is actually the images that are generated. Arche means beginning. These are the images that emerge out of the beginning.
Yeah.
Right, so there are many, right? But the problem with Jungian typologies is that they say, well, there are these sets of images in the collective psyche, because what Jung was doing was looking at, in a sense, he was doing a very European, imperialistic thing of looking at, by rationally, creating rational abstractions, and saying that these are the fact, when I get to that level of abstraction, this is the rationalist idea, right? So I get to a certain level of abstraction, so I get the magician archetype, and then I can find, you know, there's figures in North American culture that are aspects of that archetype. There's Merlin, there's Gwydion, there's John Dee, and so I say these are all aspects of this one abstract archetype.
Right.
But actually, in some of the older traditions, that isn't it at all. The archetypes emerge out of living ancestral experience. Right, so Merlin simultaneously is an image, is the image of the magical man. He is the living image that is both specifically, that holds that intention of magic and transformation, and is specifically himself.
Mm.
Right, and specifically Welsh, as in Mabthin, and has specific roots. So this is where the whole ancestral stuff combines with the archetypal. The archetypal arises out of collective ancestral experience.
Which is put together in story.
Yes.
To help us remember it.
Yes.
Story which is created, invented.
Yes.
Both by our ancestors and recreated by us.
Yes.
As we reinvent and recreate ourselves.
Absolutely. That's right.
Right, because then Jesus becomes both an archetype and much more human, so it becomes something much, being Jesus becomes much more attainable, or in an ordinary way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but that only happens because you're embodying it, right? Jesus is only human to us right now because you're Jesus. You see what I mean? Right? Jesus is not of himself. The image of Jesus is not of himself more human than Merlin. It's human because you're relating to his humanness. Now, somebody, you know, in the way that when John was describing Merlin becomes this human being who incorporates that deeper kind of energy, because he's being related to in his humanness as well as in that deeper kind of place. So there's this fusion always between the human experience and the and what we might call that kind of deeper kind of image that's arising out of the mysterious place. But it only becomes relevant and humanized as we do it, right? So we could use the image of Merlin in a totally dissociated way. You know, we could become the tribe of Merlin. Right, we've studied the Arwen, we've studied Prithayanavan, let us become the tribe of Merlin, okay? And that would be the place of us getting a bit lost in the kind of collective image, or we can use that image to bring us present to what is the ancestral mythic experience speaking to us through Merlin. Annie?
I just love it.
Yeah.
Something like, when I met the archetypes originally, they were as Shivora mentioned, they were this, they're not to do with human beings, they're just qualities like the magician and so on.
Yeah,
so they don't have a root into.
Yeah.
And so, like Margaret Thatcher, for instance, she got by the archetype of whatever she was, you could describe her as, you know, it took her over.
Yeah.
But if you have a person who then has a history or has flesh and has an archetype within them, you're relating to a very different being, if you like, because there is a being there. Whereas the Jungian way is to only go for the qualities that they are holding without any humanness, so they're really amoral and frighteningly powerful.
Yeah.
They know no mercy.
Yeah, I think the problem with the Jungian thing, though, is there are genuine problems with that Jungian idea. But absolutely, I think you're presenting that very well. But they're almost robotic in the. But that's partly because the way Jung it's because of the mechanistic image of the world that Jung was operating under. And Freud as well, you know, the mechanistic image of the human being. So, you know, Freud's image of a human being is hydraulic. You know, there are these tensions inside, you know, there's the id, which is this powerful energy of sexuality and life energy. There's this sort of super ego, which is all the keep the id down and keep the id in this bloody place. And then you've got the ego, which is this mediating, has to resolve the tension. So it's a hydraulic image, mechanistic image of a human being. Similarly, Jung, for all his much greater openness, has this desire to, partly because he just wants to understand everything, Jung. So he has this idea that abstraction, if you can get away from the content and the detail, you come into a higher level of understanding, of conceptual understanding. Now, I guess what I'm saying is I think that to understand the images and the archetypes, you have to encounter the living human experience that gives rise to those archetypal stories and ideas. So inevitably you come into relationship to ancestry and to fields of ancestry, and to the fact that these images are generated out of human experience. They're bigger than human, but they're also connected to the human. And we can and working with them involves embodying it in a way that where we receive both the ancestral gifts and the and have to balance the ancestral wounds. So if you're going to work with the image of Taliesin, you're going to work with the images of old battles and the desire to go kill the English, or to inspire people to do that.
You were saying earlier, these archetypes were originally created in imagal times, when human beings were first on the earth, making sense of it.
Yeah.
Created out of the imagination, created out of a very close connection with nature.
Yeah.
Possibly when humans didn't see themselves as different.
Yes.
Jung, by contrast, is coming after the Enlightenment, the Enlightenment,
yeah,
where rationality disconnected humans from nature.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
And therefore the archetypes became mechanical constructs.
Yes, that's right, yeah, exactly.
Unconnected to nature.
That's right.
That's right, that's right.
Different things.
That's right.
Separate from humans.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The universe itself is sort of interpreted in a very rigid way, in a mechanistic way, whereas now we have quantum physics and we talk about relationship all the time, don't we?
That's right. Yeah. That's right, and so in our...
Things being all our ancient stories being remade in a more relational way, aren't they?
Yeah. Okay, you're trying to get him.
Yeah, so just... I don't mean to be controversial, but I'm just...
Be controversial.
Challenge something.
No, challenge. Go ahead.
So, do we need them? Well, what you're saying is, from what I can gather, is that the archetype becomes a filter through which we then pick up the residual aspects of whatever archetype we're using, we're connecting with.
Yeah.
Suppose we didn't use them.
Well, we don't need the stories. Right,
because you could have a more direct experience.
That's right. We don't need the stories, right? That's one of the problems. The stories are lovely and they're good tools. Stories are tools, but we don't need the stories. We do need to understand or have a direct sense of what is driving us. Now you can not know any. I could, you know, without knowing anything about Welsh mythology, if I relate to the experience of identity, my Welshness, the images. Appropriate images and things would generate themselves. So we don't need to know stories, poetry. That's partly why we're not really concentrating that much on the detail of the stories this time. They're useful access points, but actually the archetypes are living images in us now. Right? So all we really need to do is to pay attention to what arises in us and what arises between us. And if we can maintain our sense of presence in that, we start to transform it. So it isn't like we have to learn lots of stories. Sometimes the story is useful, you know, sometimes the images are useful. Like Rob, for example, that image of Jesus is just useful but it's arisen kind of naturally. I'm interested in the topic. I know a lot of stories because they give me some understanding of the topic. But you could take all that away, right? You could just strip all that out and just get present with what's arising in me and the world. So if I just get interested in the image of me and the image of the world and find ways of being able to stay present and keep my balance in as I investigate that, then it would all, and then if you like, a sort of a new story would unfold itself.
If there weren't archetypes, you mean, wouldn't we invent them because we'd need something to explain things?
Don't we have our own archetypes? Don't we interpret our own archetypes? Don't we? You know, wherever we are in the world, we might look at it from a really Eurocentric way. We might look at it from a really Asian-centric way. We've got our different ways of having our archetypes, which are meaningful for us.
Sort of making meaning. It's a way of making meaning.
Yeah, it is, and I think I think what's happening, what we're looking at right now, to finish, of course, but it's we'll come back to it tomorrow. It's kind of interesting, right? Because I think the thing about icons of images, we can go two ways, right? We can become Catholic, want a better word, fill the place with images, or we can become Protestant. We can strip out all the images, right? And not have it, have lots of them. And we could do any of those things at any time, right? But you actually can't get away from images, whatever you do. If you fill the house with images, there's still other images will pop up. Strip out the images, other images will arise, because it's our way. It is our way of making meaning. The image is, what is an image? Let's just try and end on this. So what is actually an image? Well, it's a form that holds meaning, I think. I mean, it's a form that holds intention.
It evokes meaning.
Well, but it holds within it an intention. So the if I give somebody a present, right? A present is an image. If I've chosen it for somebody, I have my depending on my intention might be unpleasant, actually, if I give somebody a present, it's not very nice for them. But let's say I want to please somebody. My intention is to please. I listen to my sense of them, my sense of myself. And out of that, a form arises of something that will transmit my intention of wanting to please them and me and them like me, or transmit a good feeling. Now, the image which then translates into the physical object is the vehicle of that wish, that intentionality. So images, in practice, transmit intention. Now, the problem with the whole archetypal discourse and Jung and mythology and all of that is it keeps us in conventionalized expressions. Myth making is constant. Image making is constant. We continually are creating story and meaning because we're continually bringing our intention into the world and receiving the intentions of the world. So we're in a constant dialogue of wills between me and my place in the world and the world that I'm embedded in. And it brings us right back at the end to the image of myself and the image of the world and the interdependent image of myself and the image of the world. Now, archetypes, if you like, are the specifics, the specific encounters between myself and the world. They're images that arise out of and that hold particular intentions.
The archetypes, the images that hold
particular. Yeah.
Three things going on for me. It's quite complicated.
Yeah, it's very complicated to talk about these.
It comes from my ancestral life, my own archetypes. I think I've heard you saying. And then I've got the outside world, which is constantly informing me with its images and its archetypes.
And the two are deeply interrelated, so they're not separate.
No, and they're moving between.
Yeah. All the time.
Which is what, you know, which is yeah. Which.
Well, the thing is, it doesn't really matter which is which. It is what matters is to keep your balance.
Keep the balance.
Right. So actually, what happens? We need to stop now because we're in this finish. But right. But what happens is a dialogue that's going on all the time. It doesn't really matter which is which. But there's my experience and the experience of the world that's continually co-creating themselves. Yeah, and what we have to do, and so there is a static balance that keeps happening, and as we change, we have to change either by external event or by doing something internal. We have to keep our balance in the alchemy of the dialogue of wills, we could say. Let's just stop. We'll unpack this more tomorrow. It's complicated, all right, but let's just stop. Hey? Yeah, good, good. Dialogue of, I can't really remember.